Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. You know, if you stop for a second and just feel your own pulse, or even just think about the beating of a heart, it is almost a guarantee that you are focusing entirely on the squeeze.
Right, the contraction.
Yeah, exactly, the contraction, that powerful rhythmic pump that sends blood rushing through your veins. I mean, we treat the contraction like it is the only main event.
Which is, you know, it is entirely natural to think of it that way. The contraction is the action, right? It's the physical force keeping us alive.
Right.
But the biological truth is that the relaxation phase of a heartbeat, so that split second when the heart muscle actually lets go, expands, and creates a vacuum to fill with blood again, that is just as active. And it's just as mechanically complex and critical as the squeeze itself.
And that overlooked half of the heartbeat brings us to the core of what we are unpacking in our deep dive today.
It really does.
What really happens when a tiny single letter typo in our DNA makes a heart completely forget how to relax? Like, think about it like clenching your fist tightly.
There you go.
You squeeze your fingers together with all the strength you have. Now, imagine your brain is screaming at your hand to let go. You want to let go, but you find yourself physically unable to open your fingers. The muscles just refuse to yield.
Oh, wow. So your fist is just permanently locked.
Exactly. That is essentially what is happening on a cellular level in a specific severe type of heart condition.
It's a terrifying mechanical failure when you look at it closely. Because if the heart cannot relax, it simply cannot fill with blood.
And if it can't fill,
it has nothing to pump. The entire system starves for oxygen no matter how hard the muscle tries to keep squeezing.
Today we celebrate the work of researchers from the Max Delbruck Center for Molecular Medicine, Charité Universitäts Medizin Berlin, and Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, who have advanced our understanding of pediatric restrictive cardiomyopathy.
Yeah, and we should specifically highlight the efforts of lead researchers Jirko Kunisch and K. Nicole Weaver. Because what their team uncovered in this research isn't just, you know, a new data point.
Right.
It is fundamentally rewriting the rule book on how we understand cardiac genetics.
To really appreciate how those rules got rewritten, we first need to kind of set the stage. We are talking about cardiomyopathies today. For anyone who might not be super familiar with the term, these are essentially structural or functional diseases of the heart muscle itself. It's not a plumbing issue with the arteries, it is an issue with the actual meat of the heart.
Precisely. And within that clinical landscape, there are two major opposing conditions that we need to understand to make sense of this new research.
Okay, lay them out for us.
The first is dilated cardiomyopathy, which you will often hear referred to as DCM.
DCM, got it.
Right. So in DCM, the heart muscle becomes dilated. It stretches out, the walls become very thin, and the muscle gets floppy. The clinical term is systolic dysfunction, but in plain English, the heart just has a very weak squeeze.
Okay, so DCM is like an old, overstretched rubber band that has lost its snap. It just kind of bags out.
Exactly.
But if that is the case, what does the opposite even look like? Does the heart just turn to stone?
Actually, that is not far off. The second condition is restrictive cardiomyopathy, or RCM. This is the condition at the center of our deep dive.
Right.
RCM is the exact opposite mechanical problem. The heart muscle becomes incredibly rigid and stiff. This is diastolic dysfunction. The heart simply cannot relax enough to allow its chambers, the ventricles, to properly fill with blood before the next beat.
From what I saw in our source material, RCM is incredibly rare in children, like super rare. But when it does happen in a pediatric patient, it is notoriously aggressive.
It is.
It progresses fast and it seems to just laugh off standard medical therapies.
It is a devastating diagnosis, frankly, because medications generally cannot force those stiff, locked muscle fibers to let go and relax. These children almost always end up in severe progressive heart failure.
So there's no pill to just fix the stiffness?
No. Ultimately, the only real intervention becomes a full heart transplant.
Wow. That brings us to the genetic culprit we are investigating today. It's a gene called TNNI3. But I want to make sure we really understand what this gene does before we talk about how it breaks.
Of course.
What is TNNI3 actually building in the body?
So TNNI3 contains the instructions for producing a very specific protein called cardiac troponin I3.
Cardiac troponin I3.
Right. To visualize why this matters, you have to imagine the microscopic machinery inside a single heart muscle cell. This machinery is called the sarcomere.
Okay.
It is packed with these long protein filaments that physically slide past each other to create a muscle contraction. But they need a chemical trigger to tell them when to slide, and that trigger is calcium.
Calcium floods into the cell and the muscle contracts. Seems simple enough.
It is, but you desperately need a regulator. If calcium just flooded in unchecked, the muscle would be contracted all the time.
Right, the locked fist we talked about.
Exactly. That is where the troponin complex comes in. It is a three-part protein machine sitting on those sliding filaments. And cardiac troponin I3, the protein made by our gene, is the vital inhibitory component.
Meaning it stops the contraction.
Yes. It is the part of the machine that regulates exactly how sensitively those filaments respond to calcium.
Okay, wait. I have to push back a little here.
Go for it.
If TNNI3 is just one single component of a three-part complex, why does a mutation in this one specific gear cause such a catastrophic failure of the entire cardiac machine?
That's a great question. Think of the troponin complex like the braking system on a car.
That's what you do.
Troponin I3 is the actual brake pad.
Oh, I see.
The other parts of the complex are the brake pedal and the hydraulic lines. They might be working perfectly, but if you remove or damage the brake pad itself, the car is going nowhere safely. The braking system fails, the muscle simply cannot stop contracting.
The brake pad analogy really grounds it. That makes perfect sense. But here is where the story gets super fascinating. Before this new research was published, geneticists thought they had the rules for TNNI3 mutations completely figured out, right?
They did.
There was an established historical baseline that everyone just accepted as fact.
Yes, there was a very clear binary in the medical literature. It went like this. If a child had a heterozygous missense mutation in TNNI3, they would develop the stiff heart, RCM.
Let's translate that for anyone who hasn't taken biology in a decade.
Sure.
Heterozygous means you inherited one normal copy of the gene from one parent and one mutated copy from the other.
Exactly.
And missense means the genetic code just swapped out one tiny building block, one amino acid for another.
Spot on. So one altered copy equals the stiff heart. But the second half of the rule was about homozygous truncating mutations.
Okay, so homozygous meaning two bad copies.
Yes. This means the child inherited a defective copy from both parents. And the mutation is a truncation, meaning it literally chops the protein short, abolishing its expression completely. The rule stated that this scenario was entirely associated with the weak, floppy heart, DCM.
So the accepted dogma was an altered, misfolded protein gives you a stiff heart, but having no functional protein at all gives you a weak, floppy heart.
That was the rule.
But rules are made to be broken. And we didn't just find out this rule was wrong in a vacuum. To understand how this paradigm shifted, the researchers had to investigate a highly unique and frankly heartbreaking clinical case.
Yeah, it really is.
It started with a 26-month-old little girl.
That's right. This 26-month-old girl was brought to emergency care because she had suffered a stroke. Now, a stroke in a toddler is incredibly rare and alarming.
Terrifying.
Right. And the stroke itself was actually traced back to an underlying, completely unrelated genetic liver condition she had called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency.
But the stroke was almost like a tragic red herring. Because while they were evaluating her for the stroke, they did a routine echocardiogram, an ultrasound of the heart, and they discovered something completely unexpected.
They found she was in the grips of severe restrictive cardiomyopathy. Her atria, so the upper chambers of the heart, were severely dilated because blood was backing up. Her heart muscle was impossibly stiff.
Wow.
And her internal cardiac pressures were dangerously elevated. The condition was so aggressive that by the time she was 28 months old, her only option for survival was a full heart transplant.
We have to just pause and acknowledge the human stakes of that. I mean, you bring your two-year-old in for a stroke, and weeks later you are navigating an infant heart transplant. It is terrifying.
It's unimaginable.
And from a scientific perspective, the researchers were looking at this incredibly rare, complex presentation, and they needed to find the exact genetic culprit. Like, why did this happen?
Right.
To figure it out, they took a dual method approach. First, they turned to her DNA, performing clinical exome sequencing on both the little girl and her mother.
Exome sequencing is a very powerful tool. Instead of sequencing the entire massive genome, it focuses just on the exome. That's the roughly 1-2% of our DNA that actually codes for proteins.
That's like the most useful part.
Exactly. And it's generally the most efficient way to hunt for disease-causing mutation.
Doing that exome sequencing is basically like searching a massive encyclopedia for a single typo. But what makes this study so robust is that they didn't just stop at the DNA.
No, they didn't.
Because the little girl received a heart transplant, the researchers had access to her explanted original heart. They could actually look at the tissue itself.
Which is huge.
It's the difference between finding a typo in the factory's instruction manual and then actually walking out onto the factory floor to see how that typo broke the assembly line in real time.
That visual is spot on. Mm-hmm. For the factory floor analysis, they used two incredible techniques. First, immunofluorescence.
Okay, what does that do?
They use specialized antibodies that bind to specific proteins and glow under a laser microscope. That allowed them to visually track exactly where the proteins were hiding inside the cells. Then they used transmission electron microscopy, or TEM.
TEM, right.
This allows you to zoom in so far that you can see the ultrastructural nanoscale architecture of the muscle fibers themselves.
So they search the encyclopedia and they inspect the factory floor. Let's talk about what they found in the DNA first.
The sequencing revealed a homozygous nonsense variant in the TNNI3 gene.
Let me stop you there, because nonsense variant is one of those terms that sounds like an insult, but has a very specific meaning in biology.
It does.
If we read the genetic code like a long sentence, a nonsense variant means a typo essentially printed a period right where a comma should be.
Exactly.
The cellular machinery reading the instructions hits that premature period and just stops building the protein right then and there.
That is a perfect translation. And remember, it was homozygous. She inherited this exact same premature period from both parents.
But both of her parents were totally healthy carriers, right?
Yes, they were. They were heterozygous. They each had one normal copy of the gene and one copy with premature stop sign. Their hearts functioned perfectly.
Okay, so that tells us something important.
It's an incredibly important piece of data because it proves that having just one copy of this specific truncation doesn't cause heart disease. In genetics, we say there is no haploinsufficiency. One good copy is plenty to keep you healthy.
But the little girl inherited two bad copies. And this is the massive shock factor that shattered the historical rule we talked about earlier. Remember the baseline?
Or the old rule.
The literature said that homozygous truncations, having two copies of a mutation that chops the protein short, are supposed to cause dilated cardiomyopathy, the weak, floppy heart.
Yet this patient had severe restrictive cardiomyopathy, a stiff, locked heart. It completely contradicted the established genetic rules.
How is that even possible? This brings us to a really fascinating biological detour, because my immediate question is, if there is a massive stop sign right in the middle of the gene, why didn't the cell just throw the broken instructions in the trash?
Yeah, that's what you would expect.
Doesn't the body have a garbage disposal system for this?
It does, and it is a brilliant mechanism called nonsense-mediated decay. Mm. Think of it like a quality control inspector on the factory floor.
Okay.
Usually, if the inspector sees a premature stop sign in a strand of genetic instructions, they flag it, chop it up, and throw it away before the factory can even attempt to build a broken protein.
So why didn't the inspector flag this one?
Because of exactly where the typo was located. This specific stop sign happened in exon 7 of the gene.
And where is that?
In the geography of this gene, exon 7 is right at the very, very end of the sequence. Quality control inspector missed it because the premature stop sign was physically so close to the normal, legitimate end of the instructions.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the cellular machinery basically said, looks close enough to the finish line, and it built the protein anyway.
That is wild. The inspector was totally tricked by the location. So when the researchers walked the factory floor, when they looked at the explanted heart tissue using those glowing antibodies, they expected to see a complete absence of the TNNI3 protein.
Right, because of the truncation.
But instead, they found it was still there.
It was. The mutant protein wasn't entirely missing, it was just reduced by about 50%.
And when they looked through the ultra-powerful electron microscope, what did the muscle fibers look like?
It was a cellular disaster zone. The structural scaffolding of the sarcomeres was a complete mess. The borders of the muscle units were irregular. The alignment was lost.
It was totally chaotic.
Completely. And there was a massive overgrowth of mitochondria, which are the power plants of the cell, likely trying desperately to provide enough energy to unlock this stiffened muscle.
So if we connect all these dots, what exactly did this defective shortened protein look like physically?
Because it evaded the garbage disposal and was built almost to completion, the protein that resulted was mostly whole. It was just chopped short at the very end. It physically lost its flexible C-terminal tail.
So it's not totally wiped out, it's just missing its tail.
Yeah.
But why would that half-presence, that defective remnant, make the heart stiff rather than weak.
This is the critical aha moment. The C-terminal tail of this protein is the exact region responsible for binding to the other structural filaments. Going back to your analogy, the tail is the grippy part of the brake pad.
So if it's sitting in the machinery but it has no grip, what happens? Does it just do nothing?
Worse than nothing. Because this partially stable, tailless protein is still hanging around inside the cell, it acts like a jammed gear.
Okay.
The researchers synthesized that this defective remnant actually increases the muscle's sensitivity to calcium. Now, even a tiny trace amount of calcium causes the muscle fibers to lock tightly together, and the defective brake pad refuses to let them release.
It is the locked fist. The brain says let go, the muscle wants to let go. But the molecular machinery is jammed in the contract position because the broken gear is actively getting in the way. It is not just missing, it's toxic.
Precisely. And there's an even broader biological context that explains why this happened so aggressively when she was just a toddler. It has to do with how human hearts mature.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When a baby is in the womb, their heart actually uses a completely different fetal version of this troponin protein called TNNI1.
Oh, well, that makes sense. The circulatory environment in the womb is totally different than the outside world.
Exactly. But shortly after birth, the heart has to undergo a massive software update. It is supposed to switch off the fetal TNNI1 instructions and switch on the adult version, TNNI3.
But if your TNNI3 instructions are corrupted, the update fails.
The postnatal maturation crashes. The heart tries to switch to the adult machinery, but the adult machinery is missing its brake pads. This explains why the disease onset is so incredibly early and so aggressive in these pediatric patients. Their hearts literally cannot adapt to life outside the womb.
That is profound. It makes you realize how delicate that transition is. But zooming out, this completely changes how we have to view genetic mutations in cardiology. We can no longer just say, oh, they have a truncated protein, expect a weak, floppy heart.
Unquestionably. The major implication for clinical genetics is that the length of the protein truncation and the specific location of the genetic cut dictate the physical manifestation of the disease.
Location is everything.
It really is. A truncation at the very beginning of the gene gets caught by the garbage disposal, no protein is made at all, and you get a floppy DCM heart. But a truncation right near the end evades the garbage disposal, leaves a toxic jammed gear in the cell, and causes a stiff RCM heart.
It is the difference between having no brake pedal installed at the factory versus having a brake pedal that is permanently wedged against the floorboard.
Wow, yeah.
Both are catastrophic, but they cause completely different types of crashes.
That is a perfect way to summarize it. Now, as with any scientific research, we do have to acknowledge the limitations. The primary limitation here is sample size. The researchers were analyzing a cohort of exactly one patient with this specific presentation.
Which is completely understandable given how astronomically rare this is. Though the paper did note that another recent case with a very similar profile has just popped up in the literature, which strongly bolsters their findings.
Yes, the pattern is clearly beginning to emerge across the field. Another limitation to note is that because the researchers were working with frozen explanted tissue, they couldn't directly monitor that real-time fetal to adult troponin switch as it happened.
Right, because the tissue is static.
Exactly. They had to infer the failure of that software update based on the protein levels they found in the frozen tissue and the timeline of the little girl's clinical decline.
Still, the synthesis of the exome sequencing and the factory floor microscopy is incredibly compelling. It paints such a vivid, undeniable picture of how a single genetic typo can cascade into a catastrophic mechanical failure of the entire organ.
It really does. To distill all of this down, this research proves that a homozygous truncating variant in the TNNI3 gene can cause severe early-onset restrictive cardiomyopathy.
Mm-hmm.
It does this by creating a shortened, partially stable protein that jams the cellular machinery and traps the heart in a state of continuous contraction. Ultimately, the exact location of a genetic truncation dictates the physical manifestation of the disease. What does this mean for the future of personalized medicine in treating pediatric heart conditions?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science base by base. Thank you.
Opening on the thin.